No hitting, clean your room. Parents spent a lot of time trying to enforce the rules. Now, NPR's Elise Spiegel reports on new research about rules, why some work for kids and others do not.
First, let me introduce our expert.
My name is Cameron Slaughter, and I'm 8 years old.
Cameron Slaughter lives in Washington, D.C. He's in third grade and says he enjoys animals with four legs. But animals with four legs aren't Cameron Slaughter's area of expertise. His area of expertise is this: rules, specifically the rules in his own house. For example,
We always do our homework when we get home from school, and our bedtime is 7:30.
There are also rules about television, about how to address people who are older than you, and about not stabbing your brother with a pencil. And in general, Cameron says, he feels pretty good about the rules that his mother has put in place.
They kind of keep you safe.
So you appreciate the rules that she makes mostly?
Yes.
In fact, if you dig a little bit deeper, Cameron can even tell you some of the thinking behind the rules his mother has designed. For instance, why he can't watch too much television.
Because if you watch too much TV, your eyes will burn.
Or why he has to go to bed so early.
Because if you don't get that much rest, you'd be cranky.
But if you go down the list, you will find that there are some rules that Cameron doesn't think are fair or worthwhile. Rules he thinks it might be okay to disobey. For example, he doesn't think that it would be okay for his mother to regulate his personal relationships, who he spends time with.
Because I could pick my own friends.
According to Larry Nucci, a research psychologist at UC Berkeley, Cameron Slaughter's position on rules is typical. Nucci believes that if you look closely at which rules children obey and which they reject, there are clear patterns to be found.
Kids don't resist parents just across the board. It isn't a situation where kids are just driven by their impulses and that they simply reject all the rules that parents have.
Instead, Nucci argues that rules can be broken down into four distinct categories. There are moral rules, don't hit, do share. There are safety rules, don't cross the street, don't run with scissors. There are rules of social convention, you must say sir, ma'am, and
then there is this fourth category, which has to do with what children consider to be their own business and that they consider to be private. Friendships, playmates, who they want to play with, who they want to be around, activities, and some ways in which you express yourself through your appearance. Clothing, for example.
It is this fourth category, Nucci argues, where the vast majority of conflicts between parents and their children occur.
Kids don't argue at all with, or very little argument with parents when parents come up with reasonable safety rules or rules about not stealing from other children or not hitting other kids and so on. Virtually all of the conflicts that parents are having with kids are over these personal areas.
In fact, Nucci says that in studies, children seem to resist moral rules only about 10% of the time. 70% of their resistance, he says, is in areas that they perceive to fall within their personal domain. Now, this is a little bit tricky because it turns out that children and parents don't always see eye to eye about what constitutes personal business. Take bathing, for instance.
The kids see it as it's my body, it's my life. If I'm happy how I am, and I don't want to take a bath, and mom is saying no, it's unhealthy, and you're smelly, and you need to take a bath. So what the kid is doing is arguing for an area of discretion and autonomy, and the mother is arguing no, this is part of the general conventions of the family.
Nucci says that these kinds of conflicts over control of personal domain have been found by researchers to take place in every culture. And Nucci argues that, in fact, it's important for parents to respect a child's personal domain because it's important, ultimately, to psychological well-being.
What we find is that it's tied into requirements that people have for a sense of self and psychological integrity. We know from studies that have been done with adolescents, that cross-cultural studies, that when parents over-intrude, when they start controlling things that are really, truly personal, like keeping your diary private, all aspects of your self-expression, that kids, even in rural China, self-report depression.
But the idea that parents shouldn't intrude with rules on certain areas of children's lives isn't universally shared by child psychologists.
It's not what you shouldn't intervene on. It's all about the how.
This is Alan Kasdan, director of the Yale Parenting Center. Kasdan doesn't believe that there are just spheres of life where children must have autonomy. He says that if parents are looking for compliance, the primary thing is to frame rules properly and not seem too authoritarian.
What the research shows is that it's the tone of voice in the making of your request and whether you include choice in there. So if you say to your child, 4-year-old, we're going outside, put on your red coat, it's cold out. You gave the child an ultimatum kind of thinking. That is likely to lead to oppositional behavior in a 3-year-old child. Now, if you say that same thing, we're going to go outside, please put on your red coat or the green jacket, that presentation greatly increases the likelihood of compliance in any child.
So one basic difference between these two approaches is this. Nucci will argue that it's important for children to actually have control over a part of their lives, while Kasdan says that it's only important to have the perception of control. That's true, he says, not just for children, but for all people, parents included. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
There's great excitement today among scientists in Europe who've started up the world's largest atom smasher. Scientists cheered, as you could hear, and toasted with champagne after the Large Hadron Collider started making atomic particles collide head-on at record-breaking energies. The $10 billion experiment straddles the Swiss-French border and has been 15 years in the making, and now it's producing its first scientific results. Its job is to probe some of the most basic questions about our universe. Joining us to talk about that this morning and the events is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
So what has been going on at this experiment near Geneva?
Well, you got a little sense of the excitement from that brief cheer, but it's been a wonderful morning there. They have been trying to get this machine operating, and they finally did. The object is to have two beams of atomic particles traveling in a magnetic field that's sort of a 17-mile-long loop. One beam goes clockwise, the other one goes counterclockwise. They're like 10 billion particles going in each direction. And what's happening now is they're colliding and they're creating showers of new particles. And the concept of having, you know, atomic particles collide in these circular things is not a new idea, but the collision energies in this case are completely off the charts. They're at 7 teva electron volts.
7 teva. Well, Richard, tell us what that means exactly.
Well, a teva electron volt is a measure of energy. And at first glance, it doesn't seem like it's all that much because a mosquito uses about 1 teva electron volt when it's flying. That's about the energy required for a mosquito to fly. But the trick is, if you take all that energy and you pack it into a tiny, tiny subatomic space, that's actually then what's happening here, and you get a huge amount of energy in a small space in that sense. And so it's enough to blow atomic particles to bits.
And what are the scientists hoping to learn?
Well, today they're just demonstrating that the machine actually will perform, and they're already gathering data. But ultimately, what they hope to do is answer some of the big, big questions about the universe. For example, we know that only about 4% of the matter in the universe is actually visible, and the rest, according to theory, is a mix of so-called dark matter and something else called dark energy. Now, if you look at the subatomic debris from these collisions, they're hoping that they can help sort out what those sources of energy are and matter are that we can't see. And the ultimate prize would be to find a particle called the Higgs boson. It's the linchpin of modern physics. It's been predicted by a theory called the Standard Model. And some people call it the God particle, maybe a little bit over the top, but, you know, it really is critical because it could help explain how the energy from the Big Bang turned into mass. And ultimately, you know, we're made of mass, so we care about that.
Are they likely to find the Higgs particle today?
Probably not today. In fact, the current accelerator is running about half its ultimate capacity, and it will run like this for a couple of years. Then they'll turn it off, and they'll do a bunch of upgrades, and they'll fire it up again in 2013 or so. And then, even then, it'll probably have to run for another year or so before it produces enough Higgs bosons for actual study. That is, if it produces any at all, that's the big question.
Now, some people have been worried that the collider could be dangerous, and sort of the idea is if it might end up creating black holes. Is there a reason to be worried?
Well, collisions at these energies do happen elsewhere in the universe because cosmic rays pack this kind of energy. So there's all sorts of stuff like this going on in the universe, and we're still here, so that's good. There is a small chance that the collider will produce black holes, but if it does, the black holes will be extremely tiny, and they would only last for a fraction of a second. They would essentially evaporate. So physicists say there's essentially no chance that a black hole could start gobbling up the matter all around it. It's just too small.
Richard, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris.
Here's a catchphrase for you, one of the shortest forms in history. That's how the U.S. Census Bureau describes your census form. And this Thursday, April 1st, is the day the Bureau wants you to turn in that form. The 10 questions are meant to count, as accurately as possible, how many people there are in the United States on that day. And this year, the Census Bureau isn't just counting people, it's hiring them. Because of the bad economy, it's hiring very qualified people, which may lead to a more efficient census operation. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Herman Kopacek is a would-be college professor who has taught history, philosophy, and business ethics. But with teaching jobs hard to find, Kopacek and his PhD are now working for the Census. His job title?
Clerk.
Okay.
C-L-E-R-K, clerk.
And Kopacek says he's perfectly okay with that.
Some people would say I'm overqualified, but I do not look at it as any kind of step down or anything for me. I'm very happy to have this job. I get fulfillment out of it. I know I can do it well. And to tell you the truth, it's less stressful than teaching.
Kopacek is at the Seattle Regional Census Center, where his tasks include helping hire other census workers. He says he's found quite a few professionals in the same boat, well-trained but unable to find work in their chosen fields.
I've met people at my office who've had various backgrounds, economics perhaps, in creative fields such as the theater, other people with a PhD. It is absolutely due to the state of economy and more reduced opportunities.
With the unemployment rate hovering around 10%, professionals of all stripes have taken a look at job prospects and decided a temporary gig with the census looks pretty darn good. Louisa Maritza White works at the Washington, D.C. Census office.
I belong to a particular job group, and many of them are in the same position. They're professionals. They've been in the workforce for a number of years, and yet they're having a hard time landing that perfect job. So until then, this, I think, bridges the gap for many people.
White, who is 55, had been an office manager and is taking graduate courses. Her position with the census and the money it pays has come in handy.
The census job came at a perfect time. It allows me to have those additional funds that I need in order to get through school.
The census will hire over a million temporary workers for a range of jobs paying up to $25 an hour. Susan Williams is office operations assistant at the same Washington Census office. She took a census job after being laid off from her law firm.
It's tough out there. There are definitely a lot of other attorneys out there who are looking for work.
What we're finding now is the quantity and quality of the applicant pool is just incredible.
That's Robert Groves, a PhD himself. Groves is director of the Census Bureau. He says the census has been the indirect beneficiary of what he labels a terrible recession.
We have people with a depth of experience at running organizations, running some of our local census offices. We have people with much better IT skills than in general. And when it comes down to doing operations, they need the money. So they work hours that we need them to work.
The upshot, Grove says, work is getting done faster than anticipated and under budget. His only wish that the census could do even more for the unemployment rate. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams. And it's time now for All Tech Considered. This week, tech in the classroom. In many colleges and universities, gone are the days of the iconic blackboard and chalk. In its place, a software program. NPR's Joshua Brockman introduces us to a system that's rewriting how professors teach and interact with their students.
The sound of chalk on a blackboard is something you rarely hear on many campuses these days. That's because more and more professors use technology to distribute course materials, issue grades, and enhance communication with students.
I'll say it again. The line marked MunNum is testing the null hypothesis.
Philip Wirtz, a professor at the George Washington University, is presenting some complicated material during his statistics class. To help students follow along, he uses a software program called Blackboard to share slides.
It's really just a mechanism for coordinating a lot of the what would otherwise be paper in the course.
But it's not just about saving trees.
It's a one-stop shop where students can come and get absolutely any access to me, any access to the teaching assistants.
Colleges and universities are experimenting with different ways to connect students and teachers. More than 200 institutions, including Stanford and the University of Michigan, are using open-source software created by Sakai or Moodle. These classroom management systems are becoming increasingly popular because they allow schools to adapt the software to meet their needs. Blackboard, however, is the largest commercial player in the higher education market. The company has over 2,000 clients in the U.S. As students pack up their laptops, MBA candidate Brianna Lux says this software is making life easier for busy students because they can listen to classes on demand.
And it's really nice. He has all the lectures posted through. You can access iTunes U. So if ever you're doing your lab homework and what did he say in class? So you can go back, you can access it that way. And it's nice just to have everything in one place.
Eric Klopfer runs the teacher education program at MIT. He says the software can also make the classroom experience more interactive.
That potentially changes fundamentally what's going on inside the university classroom, where instead of listening to the lecture and taking notes, maybe you listen to the lecture from your dorm room, and then you actually use the class time to do other things.
And what would some of those other things be?
They could be hands-on activities, they could be labs, they could be discussions with other students.
Even though Blackboard continues to grow through acquisitions, Klopfer says the company could face competition from Google in the collegiate market. That's if the focus of learning management systems shifts because of demand for more online collaboration.
If that transition happens, a company like Google stands to gain from that because they have a lot of those collaborative tools.
Blackboard CEO Michael Chasen says his company has plans to expand into the elementary and secondary school market. Chasen says there's a lot of growth potential there, but some aggravating downsides too.
Schools are making an active effort to keep the parents more involved by using the Blackboard software. The students have expressed concerns that now their parents know too much. They know all the homework that's due. They know how they're doing in class, and we've somehow interfered with their social lives within the high school.
He's even received his fair share of angry letters and email from students upset about how they were able to continue to do schoolwork despite last month's blizzards. The technology, though, melted the snow days away. Joshua Brockman, NPR News.